So, good afternoon and welcome to Dhammaloka at the Buddhist Society of Western Australia, here in Western Australia, for all those that are live streaming it. So, very good. And my name is, for those who don't know, I think a few of you look like you are familiar, so my name is Venerable Nisarano, Ajahn Nisarano, and I'm one of the monks from the monastery in Bodhinyana, but having said that, I mainly live in Sri Lanka. So this afternoon we have a sutta reading, and I think you've got copies of it. But first, maybe the Namo Tassa.
Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhasa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhasa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhasa Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami.
So, very good. So, the sutta for this afternoon. Do many of you know this sutta? It's a very popular sutta. Do you know this? Yes. In Thailand, at least, it's called the Five Daily Recollections, and people chant it, and possibly they contemplate it too. It's the main purpose of it. So I like this sutta because it's very practical, and I feel that this is what Buddha's teaching is really about, you know, how we can apply it to our lives. And this is a very useful one to apply, because if you read the sutta, as you will in a while, you can see that it can take you from these simple, seemingly simple contemplations of our situation, human situation, to the end of the path, to Nibbana. So this is incredible. You know, in Sri Lanka quite often, I have heard, and I think it's probably more common in Burma as well, that unless you know the Abhidhamma, there's no way you're going to get enlightened. But according to this sutta, according to the words of the Buddha, that's not the case. This is quite a simple contemplation, but the power of contemplation, the power of insight, where does it come from? It comes from applying it to ourselves, to our own experience. That's where the power comes from, and seeing deeply into our experience. So, I will begin with the reading. I have got another sutta that I'll bring in as well, and hopefully we have enough time for it. So, and I'd encourage anyone here who has got questions, perhaps even on the internet, if they have got questions as we go along, to raise them if they're relevant to that period. Because I know what happens later. you forget about it, for the one thing, and also the situation, the particular context is lost. So we can begin by reading this sutta. And that's better. Starts out, because there are these five themes or subjects that should often be reflected upon by a woman or a man, by a householder, or one gone forth. And it's interesting, because the Buddha, isn't he? He's making it absolutely clear to us all, this applies to everyone, because this is the, you know, the categories of human beings that exist in the Buddha's teachings. And it applies to everyone. One gone forth, of course, is a monk or a nun. And, of course, these five daily contemplations, they apply to us all. There's nobody that's unaffected by them. If you know of anybody, please let me know. It'd be interesting to hear. What five? A woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth, should often reflect thus. I am subject to old age. I am not exempt from old age. A woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth, should often reflect thus. I am subject to illness. I am not exempt from illness. A woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth, should often reflect thus. I am subject to death. I am not exempt from death. And the fourth one. A woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth, should often reflect thus. I must be parted and separated from everyone and everything dear and agreeable to me. A woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth, should often reflect thus. I am the owner of my kamma, the heir of my kamma. I have kamma as my origin, kamma as my relative, kamma as my resort. I will be the heir of whatever kamma, good or bad, that I do. So these are the five recollections. We call them, as I say in Thailand, they call them the five daily recollections. So it's very, very immediate. But why do we contemplate these things? You know, it's quite interesting that, I don't know whether you see this, but I see that most of the time we're trying to ignore these facts, trying to ignore them as best we can. And actually, you know, people would say, oh, contemplating these things will lead us to depression and despair, perhaps even suicide. But really, the fact that we don't contemplate these things actually leads to, I think it leads to those things, because people know these are the facts, actually. These things will occur, whether we like it or not. But they're ignoring it. And they have, you know, there's a level of anxiety, isn't there, about, or fear of death is actually the one of the deepest motivations for a lot of our other problems as well. So if we look at these things, if we confront them, if we contemplate them, we can use them to actually to achieve the reverse, which is to defuse a lot of the negativity, a lot of the fear that we may have about these facts, which will happen whether we like it or not. And into the bargain, we can use it as a spiritual path for enlightenment, for awakening. So these five daily contemplations are quite powerful. So I think we'll just begin and go through them, and we'll deal with them one by one. For the sake of what benefit should a man or a woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth, often reflect thus? I am subject to old age. I am not exempt from old age. In their youth, beings are intoxicated with their youth. And when they are intoxicated with their youth, they engage in misconduct by body, speech and mind. But when one often reflects upon this theme, that the intoxication with youth is either complete or diminished. It is for the sake of this benefit that a woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth, should often reflect thus, I am subject to old age, I am not exempt from old age. So this contemplation is a very, very useful one for us these days. We live, I think, we have a lot of reminders of old age these days. We live in an ageing population. I'm part of it. Many other people are part of it. And when I was living in Melbourne recently, I would go for the alms round up near the place I was staying, And I saw so many old people, you know, and I reflected too that I'm like this as well. So we have very many reminders in our daily experience of old age, in other people particularly. But it's good, we need to apply that to ourselves. So I remember Ayakema had a really neat idea. Ayakema is a famous German Buddhist nun who passed away in 1997. That you'd look at, collect all the photos of yourself from when you were young to right to the present day. So you can see this, the aging process going on. You know, you may not be at old age, but you can see the difference. You can see that things are changing and that anicca, you know, is happening, impermanence is happening with this body. The fact of the matter is, it's happening all the time. We're actually aging as we sit here, and the body is growing older by the moment. But we're not aware of it at that level. So as I say, having photographs is often a very good reminder. And I think, you know, these days too, although this emphasises another point as well, you see it in the media a lot too, because there's so many of the famous entertainers, you know, the singers, the performers, the artists who are getting old. And I often, you know, I mean, I often see a photo, I see photographs of some of them, and I think of Keith Richards from the Rolling Stones. My goodness, he really looks old. It's incredible. So we have a lot of reminders of old age around. But the important thing for us, of course, is to realise that we are in the same boat. You know, it's very easy for young people to think, well, you know, they're old people, I'm not like that. And that's how often we think when we're young, actually. So we can use these reminders that we have in photographs of ourselves, or we can see photographs of other people, famous people in particular, that we've seen photographs of over the years. And when a person's intoxicated with their youth, it occurs to me, I don't know about you, this is when, isn't it? Young people are often enlisted into armies and things like that. And they have this sense, I know when I was young I had this sense, of being, you know, unstoppable, you know, that you don't think of death when you're young. You have no concept of it. And that's why I think armies, you know, so often, full of young men, young women these days, without a thought of the possibility that they could be dead very soon. They're sort of indestructible. We can feel like that. And this is what can drive us, this intoxication with youth, you know, this feeling that we are totally indestructible. And at the same time, because of that, of course, we can undertake a lot of things that are not for our benefit and happiness here and now or in the future. And the word intoxicated is quite a good translation for a mudder, which means infatuated, or it does mean like drunk. We're drunk, and it is something that does totally colours our mind and gives us a misperception of reality. We cannot, you know, we think we're going to go on forever. So this is. And because of that, we engage in misconduct by body, speech, and mind. I think of these recent occurrences in Australia, perhaps it's throughout the world, these one-punch attacks that people have been having, and where people get one hit and then keel over, and in a number of cases have died or had serious injuries. And usually it's not only the intoxication of youth, is it? It's usually due to intoxication from alcohol or other substances. But part of that is youth as well. And it's interesting, the Buddha says, when we contemplate this theme, the intoxication with youth is either completely abandoned or diminished. I find abandonment pretty strong, actually, because it suggests, doesn't it, that you've finished with it. So this is quite powerful if you can abandon this intoxication with youth by contemplating. You know, I would think, you know, at one of the stages of enlightenment, yes, you could do that. But he's saying here that by contemplating, we can either abandon it or diminish it. And so I'd like to just read from the Buddha's own experience about this. This is a a wonderful sutta. This sutta is from, I should have said for everyone that's on the internet too, the sutta is from the Numerical Discourses, and this version is translated by Bhikkhu Bodhi from the Wisdom Publications, and it's in the Book of the Fives. It's called Themes, and it's sutta number 57. So that's the Book of the Fives, sutta number 57, Themes. And I'd just like to read a little bit from another sutta where the Buddha talks personally about his experience of this. And this is from the Threes, that's right. It's from the Threes, and it's Sutta 39, and it's called Delicate. I don't know if you know this sutta. People know this sutta. It's lovely because it gives you an idea of the Buddha to be's background. You know, you don't get a lot of detail, but this gives you quite a bit. So I'll just read the first bit. Bhikkhus, I was delicately nurtured. Most delicately nurtured, extremely delicately nurtured. At my father's residence, lotus ponds were made just for my enjoyment. In one of them, blue lotuses bloomed, in another, red lotuses, and in a third, white lotuses. I used no sandalwood unless it was from Kasi. I think Kasi is Varanasi. It's supposed to be the best incense and best fabric. And my headdress, jacket, lower garment and upper garment were made of cloth from Kasi. By day and by night, a white canopy was held over me so that the cold and dust, heat, dust, grass and dew would not settle on me. I had three mansions, one for the winter, one for the summer and one for the rainy season. I spent the 4 months of the rains in the rainy season mansion, being entertained by musicians, none of whom were male. And I did not leave the mansion. While in other people's homes, slaves, workers and servants are given broken rice together with sour gruel for their meals, in my father's residence they were given choice hill rice, meat and boiled rice. Amid such splendour and a delicate life, it occurred to me, so he's not enlightened, an uninstructed worldling, though himself subject to old age, not exempt from old age, feels repelled, humiliated, and disgusted when he sees another who is old, overlooking his own situation. Now I too am subject to old age, and I am not exempt from old age. Such being the case, if I were to feel repelled, humiliated, and disgusted when seeing another who is old, that would not be proper for me. When I reflected thus, my intoxication with youth was completely abandoned. So here we're seeing actually the Buddha to be, he completely abandoned it by contemplating this. So we too, I think most of us, many of us have probably already abandoned the intoxication with youth. I feel like I have. Once you've had a bit of life experience, you realise that's gone. But that's how he did it. He was by contemplating it, he was able to abandon intoxication with youth. So any questions or comments? Comments? It's important that, you know, he's also in a way telling us too that if we contemplate old age, we're also, it will benefit our sila. This is what it's talking about, isn't it? Really benefit our ethical conduct of body and speech, particularly. Because when we are intoxicated by youth, we can do anything. We're unlimited, as it were. But when we realise that's not the case, that we're in the same bag, in the same boat as everyone else, then we can be more careful about how we speak and how we act towards others as well as towards ourselves. So now, and this is the second one, and for the sake of what benefit should a woman or a man, a householder or one gone for, often reflect thus, I am subject to illness. I am not exempt from illness. In a state of health, beings are intoxicated with their health. Intoxicated with their health, they engage in misconduct by body, speech and mind. But when one often reflects upon this theme, the intoxication with health is either completely abandoned or diminished. It is for the sake of this benefit that a woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth, should often reflect thus, I am subject to illness. I am not exempt from illness. So, the first question is, anybody here never been ill? Anybody on the internet never been ill? So, I think most of us are aware, you know, we have illnesses and so on. But nevertheless, you know, if the illnesses aren't chronic, if they're not there day and night for long periods of time, we can still be intoxicated with health. We can still have the idea that, you know, that health is the norm, sickness is abnormal. And as Ajahn Brahm says, you know, when we go to the doctor, we say to the doctor, there's something wrong, doctor, I'm sick. You know what Ajahn Brahm says? He said, we should go to the doctor and say, there's something right, I'm sick. So it is actually a very, very common experience. Children have it, we all have it. But we tend to ignore it and assume that these sicknesses that come from time to time they are unfortunately the underlying state of our experience. But we can easily ignore the fact that, having got over the illness, another illness can be waiting, lurking in the backdrops. So this is something that the Buddha was very aware of and spoke on a number of occasions. Yes. So, one of the things that when the Buddha mentions it a lot, do people know the Girimananda Sutta? The Girimananda Sutta, it's in the tens and there's numerical discourses. Famous sutta in Buddhist countries. It's usually chanted when people are sick, and because in the time of the Buddha there was a monk who was sick, very sick, Girimananda, Venerable Girimananda, and the Venerable Ananda came to the Buddha and said, please come and visit this monk. And for some reason the Buddha said, no, I won't come and visit, but I'll give you this teaching on the 10 perceptions. This is the basis, 10 perceptions. And you take this, you recite this teaching to the Venerable Girimananda, and he may recover. And he did, recover. And one of those perceptions is called the Ardinawa Asanya, and Ardinawa means the danger, perception of danger. And the Buddha here is talking about the danger in the body, of the body. It's a fantastic list. When I first read it, I thought, my God, this is amazing. It's covered all the illnesses that you can possibly get. It starts out with, I think, eye disease, ear disease, a nose disease, mouth disease, body disease, and it goes through the whole catalogue of, you know, diarrhea, diabetes, boils, everything, you know, illnesses due to karma, illnesses due to weather, just everything. It's a quite amazing catalogue. But the point of that is not to make us depressed, but to just give us the balance our minds, to make us realise, to reduce the intoxication with health, to say to us, these things are possible. When we take a human birth, these things come with the body. You know, we can get any of these diseases can arise, given the right conditions and causes. So it is something that, as I say, we should be aware of. And when we are aware of it, hopefully it makes us actually appreciate our health even more. So that is important. Contemplation. And I was going to ask, do people, what do you think these first two contemplations, do you recognize them as being a part of another teaching by the Buddha? Four Noble Truths, exactly. So they're both, aren't they? They're both part of the Four Noble Truths. The First Noble Truth says that old age, birth, old age, sickness and death are suffering, you know, and all the mental distress that we feel is suffering. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair is suffering. So this is part of the Four Noble Truths, and this is part of the human heritage. When we're born with a body, this is what we inherit. So it's very useful when we're reflecting on Dhamma to use the Dhamma focusing on our experience. Not only is it the Four Noble Truths, it's also the characteristic of anicca, the characteristic of impermanence, that things don't last. Our youth doesn't last, our health doesn't last. It will come and go. So that's the. So they're teaching us. Our body is teaching us. Our experience is teaching us. Now, yes. So, just for what the Buddha's experience, he says, again, it occurred to me, an uninstructed worldling, though himself subject to illness, not exempt from illness, feels repelled, humiliated and disgusted when he sees another who is ill, overlooking his own situation. Now I too am subject to illness, and I am not exempt from illness. Such being the case, if I were to feel repelled, humiliated and disgusted when seeing another who is ill, that would not be proper for me. When I reflected thus, my intoxication with health was completely abandoned. So that's the bodhisattva. He wasn't a Buddha at that stage, a bodhisattva. It really shows you too, doesn't it, that even, you know, when he was living the very, you know, luxurious life in the palace, he's still very contemplating things at a very deep level, you know, because many, quite often when you read suttas, you realise as a bodhisattva, a lot of the teachings that came later, a lot of the realisation of the Four Noble Truths, they actually have their roots quite early in his experience. How early, it's hard to say, but definitely there before he became, he left the home life. So now for the next one. And for the sake of what benefit should a woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth, often reflect thus, I am subject to death. I am not exempt from death. During their lives, beings are intoxicated with life. And when they are intoxicated with life, they engage in misconduct by body, speech and mind. But when one often reflects upon this theme, the intoxication with life is either completely abandoned or diminished. It is for the sake of this benefit that a woman or a man or a householder or one gone forth should often reflect thus, I am subject to death, I am not exempt from death. And of course, the contemplative collections that the Buddha recommended to us all, it's called Marinasati, and it's a part of the four protective meditations. Have you heard of the four protective meditations? Chaturaka Bhavana. And they are Buddhanasati, Metta. These are two uplifting sorts of contemplation. So when the mind is maybe depressed, lacking in energy, then we can contemplate the Buddha, the qualities of the Buddha, or we can develop Metta. But when the mind is infatuated, overtaken, agitated, then we can focus, we can contemplate death. That calms the mind down, brings peace to the mind. And we can also, the last one is asubha nisati, which is contemplating the unattractiveness of the body. Our bodies, all bodies, are of the same nature. And those two last contemplations, they're aimed at reducing agitation, lust in the mind, balancing it. So this is a part of those recollections. And it's an important one that, as I say, balances the mind. It's also interesting where the Buddha says that when they're intoxicated, they engage in misconduct by body, speech and mind. You know, so our mental, the karma we are making by mind is actually very important too. Because that's what actually the world we live in is the world that we create through our thinking, you know, habitual thinking. So, and I'd like to, this is where we can also reflect, do we know anybody that hasn't died? Nobody, I think everybody's met somebody, heard of somebody or knows somebody that has died. And in Buddhism we have quite a strong tradition that people might be aware of, where we remember death anniversaries. And this is very common in Sri Lanka, in Buddhist countries in general, but particularly in Sri Lanka. And I always, on these occasions, we do something good in order to share or dedicate the energy from that goodness to a person who's passed away. Often it can be of assistance if that person can be aware of it and maybe help with a better rebirth. This is the idea. And if they can be aware, of course, it will bring them happiness to know that they're being remembered. But I always say to people, or you should say to people, like I did this morning, that when we celebrate, or when we participate in something, making good karma and to share it with other beings, we should also remember one fact. One day we may be in the same situation, we will be in the same situation, that we will have died, and maybe people will be making merit for us, they will be remembering us. So these death anniversaries have quite a deeper purpose. Usually when I say that, at these occasions, people, that's not what they're thinking of. Because often when we go to funerals and we hear of somebody who's died, we have within us the thought is, well, it's not me, you know, it's not me. So, you know, people often think that, but they don't realise, yes, one day it will be me, actually. One day it will be me. And one of the monks in Sri Lanka, quite a famous monk there now, has this amazing advice for when you go to a funeral. You know, it's maybe a friend's funeral, family member's funeral. He said, when you see the coffin or when you see the body, in your mind, just see yourself there in that coffin. See yourself lying on that that table. In Sri Lanka, they have a very nice custom, and it's still current, actually, where you have the body at home for about 3 days. And all the neighbours, family, friends, they come and they pay their last respects to that person. And the monks usually visit too. And it's a good reminder for everybody. And yet it's also a social situation. I often wonder how the family copes because, well, I know how they cope. The friends, the family, the other villagers, they bring food and they have tables. And it's quite an occasion before they actually cremate or usually bury the body, actually, if you're in the country. So this is something that reminds us again and again, but somehow we manage to let it slip from our minds. A very good contemplation is, and I mentioned this Friday night talk, is to contemplate, to make this contemplation real, very real for us, is to imagine that we've been to the doctors and the doctor said, sorry, I've got bad news, you've only got 3 days to live. And then just to use that as a contemplation, just see what your reaction to it is, you know, the resistance to death, to the idea of dying, what it means, what's important in our lives when we have such news. So that's and in Sri Lanka there's also, they have, you know, when I was mentioning the Chaturaka Bhavana, the four protective meditations, the one on death, it's in Pali, but the meaning of it is great, it's really good. I don't know whether people in Sri Lanka realise what the meaning is actually, but it's really good, which is, it's using images from the suttas, but I'll just read a few of them because they're really striking actually. Death is like a candle exposed to the wind. That's great. All who achieve great success have died. So too, death will overcome me. With birth, death always comes, like a murderer with a sword following behind. As the arisen sun runs to setting, so to me. Death is like lightning, a bubble, a dewdrop, or a line drawn on water. Death quickly killed the Buddha, possessed of great fame, strength, merit, spiritual power, and wisdom. And then this is the important one. What about me? What about me? So this is, then it goes on actually. When internal and external conditions are not there, I who am dying at every moment may die in less time than it takes to blink. This is actually in the chanting. It's really amazing. So we don't know when, where or how we will die. But it will happen at some time. usually when it's not convenient. Often, there's a marvelous simile that Suzuki Roshi, made, which was that we're like people who are embarking on a boat trip. We've got on a boat, on a ship, a boat, heading out to sea, knowing that that boat will sink, either close to the shore, further out, or in the middle of the ocean. I usually update that now to more like, it's like we're getting on a Malaysian Airlines flight. I shouldn't say that, actually, but it's like that. Those people that got on that flight, they were not expecting to die. And we're in the same boat. We've got on a flight, and it will crash sometime or other. You know, either on the runway or later. So it is very good to, you know, just bear this in mind. And as I say, it's not intended to depress us. I mean, people may find that depressing, actually. But actually, it makes us realize how precious our time is that we have and what we have. And that the people and the things that we have in our life are quite precious, especially the people, precious. And we should, they are also subject to death, so that they too can disappear at any time in our lives. So that is, anybody like to raise a comment or question? It's interesting. That's a very good question. Is this misconduct that the Buddha refers to by body, speech and mind related to the individual contemplations, you know, to old age, sickness and death, you know, that we're trying to avoid contemplating these themes? And my answer would be no. I think it's a very good question. I thank you for asking, because really it's referring to the whole area of sila, our ethical conduct by body, speech and mind, and very, very specifically, isn't it, the five precepts that we undertake. This is an individual undertaking to refrain from killing or harming beings. We undertake to refrain from taking what is not given, this is stealing. We undertake to refrain from sexual misconduct. We undertake to refrain from lying. We undertake to refrain from alcohol and drugs that cloud awareness, that make us careless. It's pointing to the five precepts. Usually in the Buddha's teaching too, there is the 10 courses of unwholesome actions. So included in body and speech would be, divisive speech, where we divide people against other people, either by telling a lie that we've heard these other people have said something about this group, and we tell that group, or it could be true, it could be a lie, but the intention is to divide. And also there is parusavacha. This is rough speech, coarse speech, something very big in Australia. And the last one is gossip. Gossip or idle chatter, we call it. So these make up body and speech. And the last three are the Buddha is referring to in the 10 courses of unwholesome action, are also like covetousness. This is greed for other people's things. Very strong greed. And also negativity, anger, aversion, also focused at other people, maybe even ourselves. And the last one is wrong view. I always say wrong view is like having a view that's in opposition to reality. Because I say right view is what the Buddha saw when he was enlightened. And it's in a reflection of reality. It's not reality, but it's a reflection, a conceptualization of reality, what he experienced. So when we are coming from wrong view, we're in collision with reality and we will suffer. So thank you for that. So it's really the 10 courses of unwholesome action. When they say dasa kusala pata. Yeah. So now we can get on. Go. Ah, right. And going back to the Buddha. Again, it occurred to me, an uninstructed worldling, though himself subject to death, not exempt from death, feels repelled, humiliated and disgusted when he sees another who has died, overlooking his own situation. Now, I too am subject to death and am not exempt from death. Such being the case, if I were to feel repelled, humiliated and disgusted when seeing another who has died, that would not be proper for me. When I reflected thus, my intoxication with life was completely abandoned. And I might just read this little bit before we continue, because it will fit in here. There are, because these three kinds of intoxication, what three? Intoxication with youth, intoxication with health, intoxication with life. An uninstructed worldling intoxicated with youth engages in misconduct by body, speech and mind. With the breakup of the body, after death, he is reborn in the plane of misery, in a bad destination, in the lower world, in hell. And then second, an uninstructed worldling, intoxicated with health, engages in misconduct by body, speech and mind. With the breakup of the body, after death, he is reborn in the plane of misery, in a bad destination, in the lower world, in hell. And the third one, an uninstructed worldling, intoxicated with life, engages in misconduct by body, speech and mind. With the breakup of the body, after death, he is reborn in the plane of misery, in a bad destination, in the lower world, in hell. That's it. Is that good? So that's an important contemplation. And of course, everyone here probably remembers that we have the very popular story of the Buddha, actually the Bodhisattva, before he was the Buddha-to-be, going out from the palace, from his luxurious accommodation to his father's park with his charioteer, Channa, and driving through the streets, and for the first time seeing an old person, seeing a sick person and a dead person on subsequent days. And because of that, then the fourth thing he saw, a holy person, somebody, a monk, not a Buddhist monk, obviously, walking. And he saw those four signs, and because of those four signs, he was motivated, propelled to leave the family life, the home life, and to go into homelessness, as we say, become a monk. To seek for the truth. And this is the noble search that he embarked on. So we shouldn't think, people who think these three things, well, they're sort of everyday, they're actually the things that propelled the Buddha to be into the holy life, to become a Buddha, actually. So they're very important reflections. So. Yes, that it does seem to indicate in the story that he was experiencing them for the first time, but the sutta that we read just a little while ago does seem to indicate that he'd been contemplating it for some time. And this is only actually even though it's a very popular story, it's never told in the suttas, and it's more of a commentarial story. So whether it is actually true, it's hard to say, you know. Most in Buddhist countries, it's taken to be very accurate, to be the actual experience of the Bodhisattva. But I think, how could he be so protected? Ordained sickness and death would be, he would have seen, actually, I think, even in the palace in some form or other. Because the story goes that he was so protected he never saw any of these things. So when he saw them, they really just bowled him over. He was completely, alarmed and dismayed, and said to his charioteer, what is this old person? Absolute shock and horror. And then the charioteer tells him, Channa says, this is an old person who's come to the end of their life. And all beings are of this nature. And the Bodhisattva says, myself included. And so it really struck home. But I think this is a really dramatic presentation, perhaps, of his own ongoing contemplation before this, actually. But nevertheless, sometimes, isn't it, these experiences in daily life can be a real catalyst for big insights to occur. You may have seen a sick person, an old person, a sick person, a dead person before, but suddenly, you know, it really hits you. You know, this, I'm of the same nature. We're all in the same. Compassion is the fact that we are all in the same boat. So I better continue because the time is going. And for the sake of what benefit should a woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth, often reflect thus, I must be parted and separated from everyone and everything dear and agreeable to me. Beings have desire and lust in regard to those people and things that are dear and agreeable, and excited by this lust, they engage in misconduct by body, speech and mind. But when one reflects upon this theme, the desire and lust in regard to everyone and everything dear and agreeable is either completely abandoned or diminished. It is for the sake of this benefit that a woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth, should often reflect thus, I must be dear and agreeable to me. So this is an experience that we all have. And of course, as I mentioned before, this is part of the First Noble Truth. The Buddha says that suffering is being associated with those people and things that are not dear to us, that we don't like, and being separated from those people and those things that are dear to us. So then this is part of the Noble Truths as well. And it's the desire and lust in regard to those people and things that are dear and agreeable and excited that lead people into these misconduct by body, speech and mind. I hardly think we need much explanation or description of that. I mean, we see what people will do, you know, in the name of love, if they call it love, actually. You know, they will kill the person that they love, you know, that they're so infatuated, they must have that person. And we see it with material things, too. People go to extraordinary lengths, you know, doing things to get things. You know, to get power, to get property, get money, all these things, you know, extraordinary corruption and misconduct. So I think we're all quite well aware of this, and this is part of the human situation, that what we tend to like, we tend to develop this grasping for, isn't it? We call it tanha in the Pali language, the ancient Buddhist language. And then it becomes an attachment, upadana, or clinging. And these things become such an important part of our lives. And we also don't realize that all these people and things that we're clinging to are impermanent too. They won't last. They can't last. If we tried to grab on to a moving car, we'd just be suffer, maybe even be killed, even die. So it's because of this. This is actually one of the worldly winds that I mentioned on Friday night, that we have this attachment to people and things, getting and gaining. One of the important things too, that I think this translation, even though it's by Bhikkhu Bodhi, and I'm not a Pali scholar, but when he says here, I must be parted and separated from everyone and everything dear and agreeable to me, I think the Pali is actually saying that, yes, we'll be separated, but parted and separated to me, I don't know whether you would agree, is the same thing, is it not? Parted, separated. But I think nana bhavo is the Pali for it, is actually pointing to the fact that they will become different. And this is actually in line with our experience. So, for instance, you know, we may love a particular woman or a particular man, but later, maybe not much later, we no longer love them. We may even hate that person. So our minds have changed. It's not that we have been, as it were, well, we are parted from them, but our perception of them, the way we look at them, has changed. So they're no longer important to us. In fact, they may be the very opposite. So I think that the where he says apart and separated, I would say separated, and that they have the way we see them has changed, has become different. So that's, and that actually fits in with, I don't know if it fits in with your experience, but certainly fits in with my experience, I think human experience, that sometimes the things that are so, so dear to us and we can't live without, and later on they're not so important to us for whatever reason. And they may even be, we might have the opposite, where we no longer can stand them. So it's possible. So that's one thing, that's one point that I thought worth mentioning. So now we better move on, because the time is going. And for the sake of what benefit should a woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth, often reflect thus, I am the owner of my kamma, the heir of my kamma. I have kamma as my origin, kamma as my relative, kamma as my resort. I will be the heir of whatever kamma, good or bad, that I do. People engage in misconduct by body, speech and mind. But when one often reflects upon this theme, such misconduct is either completely abandoned or diminished. It is for the sake of this benefit that a woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth, should often reflect thus, I am the owner of my kamma, the heir of my kamma. I have kamma as my origin, kamma as my relative, kamma as my resort. I will be the heir of whatever kamma, good or bad, that I do. So I think this reflection on kamma, of course, is a very important one in Buddhism, and important for our lives, actually, too, because so often we don't take responsibility for our actions. And when we say, I'm the owner of my kamma, that's what we're saying, isn't it? That I'm responsible. It's not somebody else, you know, it's not the government, it's not my husband, my wife, it's myself. I'm responsible for this kamma, and I'm the heir of my kamma. So what I'm experiencing from in the present has come from the past. What I'm doing now will influence what I experience in the future. So it's very it's showing us that we are making our destinies. It's not fixed, because what we do in the present will affect what we experience in the future, whether pleasant or unpleasant. And I have kamma as my origin. We often think when we come into this life, it's birth is the origin. But we have kamma that has brought us to this birth as a human being. And that's very good kamma, actually. Very good kamma. So this is what's brought us to a human birth. It's not an accident. It's not. Sometimes, you know, I hear, you do hear this, and I'm sure parents here have heard it. Children may say to their parents, I didn't ask to be born. No, this is not true. In Buddhism we say, you know, that actually they were their desire to be born again has brought them to a birth, and their kamma from the past allowed them to be born as a human being. And kamma is my relative. So our relatives, you know, can be a mixed bag. They're usually a great support, but they can also be the source of our great suffering as well, as many people are aware of. So it depends on what sort of kamma we're doing as to what sort of relatives we're experiencing. Kamma as my resort. So this is various translations of that, kamma as my, this is our refuge in a sense. If we have created good kamma, it's quite a strong refuge. Of course, if we've created bad kamma, then it's very unpleasant for us. And of course, the contemplation reminds us that we're heirs of whatever kamma, whatever actions of good or bad that I do. Should mention that kamma translates as action, so. So this is very important, that we take responsibility for our actions of body, speech and mind. Here, you know, we often have these excuses, don't we? I had to do it. He made me do it. She made me do it. These sorts of things, you know. it's not my fault, it's not my fault, you know, which might be true actually. So that we've got to be aware of the things that, you know, that we, no matter what we experience, no matter what somebody says or does to us, no matter how extreme, even if it is torture and so on, we have got some power over how we react. We don't have to react negatively, react unwholesomely. And of course the famous example almost that the Buddha uses is the simile of the saw, you know, that if your limbs are being sawed off by bandits, if you were to raise a mind of ill will towards these bandits who are mutilating you, then you would not be following the Buddha's teaching. That's amazing. But he's using that as an extreme example, as you, when you read that sutta, because he's saying later in that sutta, he says, whatever you experience in terms of what people say to you or do to you, can it ever be as bad as what the simile of the saw, these bandits? It's like a standard. It's so extreme, so that if somebody abuses you physically or verbally, it's nothing compared to the simile of the saw, these bandits sawing off one's legs and so on. So one can bear with what the people say and do. So that's quite an extreme example. And I like the fact that the Buddha, very often, he uses these extreme images that, and for what purpose? So they stick in the mind, actually, stick in the mind. I don't think the Buddha actually expected any of us, especially if we're not enlightened, to be able to bear with our limbs being sawed off and not give rise to ill will, aversion, hatred. That's not possible. Of course, for a fully enlightened person, yes, that would not be difficult. It would be difficult, but not difficult, but it would be painful. So, so now we better move along as we're getting close to the end of the class. So, and this we can abbreviate, I think. This noble disciple reflects thus, I am not the only one who is subject to old age, not exempt from old age. All beings that come and go and pass away and undergo rebirth are subject to old age. None are exempt from old age. As he often reflects on this theme, the path is generated. He pursues this path, develops it, and cultivates it. As he does so, the fetters are entirely abandoned and the underlying tendencies are uprooted. So this is amazing, isn't it? It's really extraordinary when you read this, that by contemplating old age, the fact that we're not exempt to it, and then universalizing it, seeing that it's not only myself, but all beings are subject to old age, that by contemplating this, reflecting on this, we can generate the path. And now the path, of course, is the path to awakening, path to enlightenment. And why would you think that would be possible? What would be the insight that would push someone, would an able person contemplating old age, what would be the insight that could allow them to make a breakthrough to the path to awakening, to enlightenment? Exactly, 100%, yes. Because this is what gives rise to the first path and fruit, which is seeing anicca, and we often hear it expressed as yang kinchi samudaya dhammang sambantang nirodha dhammanti. And this means whatever is of the nature to arise, that all of that is subject to cessation. So seeing impermanence at a very deep level, at a very deep level. And this comes from contemplating old age. So when one does that, he says that the path is generated. This is interesting because often, you know, particularly in Abhidhamma, they have the idea that when the path arises, this is the path of the stream enterer, when it arises, one mind moment later, the fruit of stream entry will arise. And I think this is suggesting, as this is how I would read it, is that the path arises, but you haven't necessarily received the fruit of that path. It hasn't necessarily come to you, that you haven't broken through the first three fetters, which are destroyed when one becomes a sotapanna. Because he continues, the Buddha continues, doesn't he? He says, he pursues the path, develops it, and cultivates it. So he's travelling on this path and developing it. And as he does so, the fetters are entirely abandoned and the underlying tendencies are uprooted. So it suggests that, for instance, there is this moment of breakthrough where you see anicca at a very, very deep level, anicca, impermanence, nothing lasts. And from that, one then continues to develop that perception, that understanding, and cultivate it. And as one does that, then the fetters are entirely abandoned. This is the first three fetters, when one becomes a Sotapanna, or a Sowan, they say, in Sri Lanka. And the fetters which the Buddha is referring to are, and this is the new translation from Bhikkhu Bodhi, personal existence view, sometimes self view, the idea that there is a self here that's permanent, lasting, won't, goes on forever. This idea that there is a personal essence that is indestructible is destroyed. And then doubt is the second fetter that is destroyed. Doubt as to, they usually say about the enlightenment of the Buddha, Dhamma, and about the Sangha. So those three doubts. Because one has had an enlightenment experience, and so one's seen, yeah, what the Buddha experienced is my experience. And what the Dhamma said, what the Dhamma he taught, is my experience. And others have actually experienced this. So this is usually how doubt is described. And the third thing that is destroyed by the first experience of fruit, the fruit moment when one becomes a Sotapanna or so on, is the wrong grasp of behaviour and observances. Bhikkhu Bodhi is calling that now. And that's the idea that by a particular type of behaviour, a particular type of spiritual observance, one will become enlightened. And so, for instance, you have at the time of the Buddha people who were practicing and thinking by behaving like a cow or a dog, one, an ox or a dog, one would become fully enlightened. And the Buddha told them, no, at best you'll become an animal in your next life. So these are the sorts of fetters that he's talking about. But I'll move on more quickly. And the other fetters that are broken by the higher stages of the path are sensual desire. This is a desire for all the experiences of the senses. Ill will. This is all the negativity, irritation, annoyance, fear, anxiety, all those sorts of things. Lust for the form realm. So this is for existence in like a jhana-like experience, which is incredibly blissful and happy. This would be the jhana realms. And lust for the formless is the formless realm. So the realms of mental experience and existence that are incredibly blissful, peaceful, and satisfying. And number eight is conceit. This is the comparing of ourselves to other people, thinking we are either better, this is, or we're the same, or we're less than. So it's that comparing behaviour. And this is only lost by the arahant, actually. The person who becomes an arahant, he destroys that fetter, so it's quite a late one. And restlessness and ignorance, they are the fetters that are destroyed. And in this paragraph, the Buddha also mentions that the underlying tendencies are uprooted. And the underlying tendencies that he's talking about, they're very similar, actually, to the fetters. The fetters are called fetters because they bind us to what? To samsara, to being born again and again. And the underlying tendencies, they seem to be the more active aspects that come up during our lives. Sometimes they're dormant and then they come up with the right conditions. So they are sensual lust, aversion, views, doubt. So these are very similar, aren't they? Conceit, lust for existence. This is like the form realms of the jhanas or the formless realms. And they're very similar. So these are abandoned and one can develop the path to full enlightenment. And so it is the same for when we reflect on illness. I am not the only one for illness. I am not the only one. Relative, Kama as resort, who will be the heir. cultivates it. And as you're telling us there, isn't any of these take us apply them to our is like a contemplation that just somebody else, not me. So this is showing the power of this. And of course, do people recognize a lot of these factors actually come also from paticca-samuppada, dependent origination, especially, aging and death, and all these things actually are part of that, a part of dukkha actually. So they can take us to the end of dukkha as well. So we can just finish with, because we're now over time, with the verses, which are very nice at the end of it. Worldlings subject to illness, old age and death are disgusted by other people who exist in accordance with their nature. So this is very similar to what the Buddha was talking about when he was a bodhisattva, being humiliated, disgusted and repelled by seeing, beings that were old, sick or dead. If I were to become disgusted with beings who have such a nature, that would not be proper for me, since I too have the same nature. It's interesting, Bhikkhu Bodhi says these verses are actually better attached to the other sutta we read. They are the same, actually, in the other sutta. These verses are the same. So they may have actually got applied to this one at a later stage. And then he goes on, while I was dwelling thus, this is contemplating these things, having known the state without acquisitions, I overcame all intoxication with health, with youth, and with life, having seen security in renunciation. So this is pointing to, it would seem to me, quite an advanced state, actually, a stage. What would people think the state without acquisitions was? Acquisitions is sort of like all the defilements, the things that we are attached to, the attachment to the five khandhas, the body and the mental aspects of our experience. It almost sounds like Nirvana, doesn't it? But it can't be, because it's still at an early stage before he became the Buddha. And having seen the security in renunciation, seeing that the path that the Buddha is teaching is a path of letting go. It's not a path of acquiring, getting, gaining. It's a path of letting go of all that we don't really need, the negative states of mind, the defilements, all the things that cause us suffering. And then the last verse, very beautiful, this is very nice. Zeal then arose in me as I clearly saw Nibbana. Now I am incapable of indulging in sensual pleasures, relying on the spiritual life. Never will I turn back. So that's quite a lion's roar, we call in Buddhism, lion's roar. So he has, in that last verse, he has seen Nibbana. And of course, when one has seen Nibbana, one's incapable of indulging in sensual pleasures, because one has seen something far, far better. And in fact, by the time one gets to that stage, sensual pleasures don't look like much fun at all. They look like suffering, which we probably think, my goodness, how is that possible? I still like my cup of tea. I still like this and that. And relying on the spiritual life, never will I turn back. And so that's wonderful. So are there any questions or comments about any of that? Ah, we've got one from the internet, I think, so let's see. How can you say that? I hope it's not from Malaysian Airlines. PJ from Singapore. How do we help those who are afraid of these five contemplations to see the truth and overcome their denial? That's a really good point, actually. You have to do it very sensitively, actually. I can do it like this, because you're all interested in Buddhism, you all have some understanding of the Buddha's teaching, so therefore you're sort of prepared. But if you speak like this to most people who have no idea of the Buddha's teaching, they may be shocked, they may not be able to cope with it, they may be even in more denial, more distress. So you have to use your sensitivity, PJ from Singapore, to bring these to discuss these sorts of things. And the thing that I find very, very useful for that is to not separate ourselves from others, because we realise we are all part of this. You know, as I said before, we're all in the same boat. It's not as if, you know, I won't experience old age, sickness and death. I'm experiencing some of this already. So we're all in the same boat. And when I go and visit, and various monk and other clergy are in the same situation, to visit people who are dying. And that's a real privilege, because that is a time that's very important, you know, for that person. And I never feel, you know, like a separation from them, that I'm, you know, standing back from them. I just think, I may not have a double brain tumour, like a young man I was visiting, 34, with a double brain tumour, dying. I may not have that, but I'm capable of this. I'm in the same boat. So then, PJ, we can have a lot of compassion and emphasise that it's the common experience, the experience of all of us, and then it takes some of the sting out of it for people. So thank you for that question, PJ from Singapore, and Joe from Sweden. How does reflection on death and paying respect to a dead person at the time, or even years later, go along with the conception of no self, non-self? How does? Yes? Wow. Non-self. Well, the whole process of life and death is just a process, isn't it? And what we are paying respect to and remembering with a person who's died, you know, in a death anniversary, is for their contribution to our lives, how they've touched our lives. And we know, and perhaps taken a rebirth somewhere else, well, they definitely take a rebirth somewhere else, is not necessarily the same person. In the same way, I like the illustration from the Questions of King Melinda, which is a later text, where, you know, you reflect that, you know, when I was young, you know, when I was a child, think of that time and think of myself now. Am I completely different from that child, you know, say 5 years old, or am I the same? Well, we're not completely different, but we're not the same. In the same way, when we go from one life to the next, we're not completely different. The consciousness that's flowed on, the stream of consciousness, has got many of the characteristics that we've developed in the past. Has to. Has to. But our experience, ongoing experience, modifies it. So it doesn't in any way undermine the concept of non-self. And it does also point to the fact of our attachments to people. And, you know, but also gratitude, because, you know, for instance, if we remember our parents or friends, we're grateful for the many kind things they've done for us in the past while they were alive. So I hope that sort of relates death, the paying respects to people when they've died, death anniversaries, and the concept of non-self for Joe from Sweden. And Shivam from India. Do these five contemplations have more deep impact subsequent to deep meditation experience, or are they equally beneficial in contemplating during our daily life? Oh, that's a good one. Well, of course, you know, they will have a lot more impact after deep meditation, because, isn't it, the mind is so much stiller and we can see so much more deeply into our experience. So, yes, it will have a lot more impact in after deep meditation. However, yes, we can contemplate them during our daily routine life. And it does help. It does help very much, you know. Because if you, for instance, you know, if you contemplate, you know, I'm of the nature to die, I'm not exempt from death. And how can we hang on to annoyances, irritation, grudges and things? It really puts things into perspective. You know, so it does reduce a lot of the negativity in our daily life by just keeping these things in mind, that I am of the nature to die. This person I'm angry with is also of the nature to die. And so these things, these contemplations can be very useful for us in daily life, and also to reduce our attachments to people and things in our experience. So I thank you for that, Shivam from India. And the most important thing with Buddha's teaching is you try it out. You try this at home. that has benefit for you. And I think contemplating all these five contemplations of old age, sickness, death, and being parted from what is dear and delightful, and also our karma, they're very useful in daily life too. One of the very beneficial things of contemplating karma, especially when you're very angry with somebody, upset with somebody, you realise that they are heir to their karma too. So even if they've done something really dreadful or said something really dreadful, they will get the results of that. I don't need to hang on to it. It helps us let go, actually, because we realise they're going to get the results of this, you know, and I need not suffer more than I've already suffered. So that's very important. So they're useful in daily life too. And as I mentioned at the beginning, in Thailand at least, they are referred to as the five daily contemplations and chanted in Pali and hopefully reflected on in terms of personal experience. So thank you very much, you from India. And I think now we can finish the sutta class. I hope that's been beneficial. By paying respects to the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha. It's amazing, isn't it? Short sutta, and it took a long time.
Pano Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sangam Namami.
Oh, there you go. So I hope you use these five daily contemplations. That's good. Great. Hello. I better turn it off, I think. Bye-bye, Internet.